This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Think about some of the conditions on the newly formed planet Earth. Volcanic activity, temperatures around 100 degrees Celsius. Not exactly a garden spot for life. But research now is discovering new species of bacteria that can thrive in those conditions, and some are still around today.
Adaptation and evolution is all about building on adaptations that have happened previously.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our astrobiology series returns with a look at the discovery of new species of life on Earth in the hot spots of the planet. Plus, we'll spend an academic minute finding out how some conditions on today's Earth can force a change in the way some living things process carbon and oxygen. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. It's pretty safe to assume that most of you probably believe that humans have cataloged all forms of life on Earth. As you might guess, it would be safe to assume that you were wrong. New species of bacteria and other organisms are being discovered all the time. That's what Penn State University's evolutionary biologist Blair Hedges told our science reporter David Gustina as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. It's part of his work in the hot spots of the coevolution of life and Earth.
So the evidence that I'm looking for in these organisms is what organisms are the earliest branching, for example, among living bacteria, because the earliest branching ones in the tree, in the family tree of bacteria, would possibly retain characters that would give us a clue as to the early environment. For example, when we build trees of bacteria, the earliest branching ones live in high temperature environments. In other words, when I say high temperature, of course, boiling is 100 degrees centigrade, and some bacteria can even survive above that. And these would be very high temperature bacteria. And anything close to that, maybe 70, 80 degrees centigrade, would also be very high temperature. It's hard for any eukaryote, any group of organisms like plants or animals, to survive above 50 degrees centigrade. So these are very, really high temperatures that we're talking about. So it turns out that the most basally or earliest branching species of these bacteria are ones that tend to live at these high temperatures. And it suggests that they've retained this, you could say, physiology or behavior for a billion years, and that maybe that was the environment then. The inference is that these large asteroid impacts that we know, well, I should say, we don't have evidence, but we presume occurred based on the moon's surface and other indirect evidence like that, that when they boiled the Earth, they would have subjected these species to very high temperatures, and which is what we're seeing.
And they managed to survive.
Yes, and they managed to survive, and they did better than, almost certainly they did better than species that were not adapted to such high temperatures.
No, obviously we know that the Earth has cooled since then and has become habited with abundant life. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if there's an inference there too, Dr. Hedges, that if these microbes were able to survive under such high temperatures, is there anything that occurred among them as the Earth cooled that created these building blocks for plant or animal life? Or is that too much of a stretch?
Well, no, it's not a complete stretch, because it's all adaptation and evolution is all about building on adaptations that have happened previously, you know, existing variation. So more than likely, those species have just, they just moved around to niches that have remained hot. For example, the early events were not really representative of a hot early Earth in general. They were single events where there was a collision on basically a mild or cool Earth, and it made it hot for a relatively short period of time, like a few hundred years or a thousand years. And then species that were adapted to the high temperatures moved to areas like the deep sea vents that are still hot. And
where we still find these
microbes. Find them, exactly. Or the geysers in Yellowstone National Park as well. So, yeah, and what you mentioned about building blocks for more complex life is also very relevant here, because one of the hot spots involves the origin of oxygen, which is very important for complex life. It gives us much more energy than we would have without oxygen, about almost 20 times as much energy. And that's really needed for multicellular life. When you have multiple cells and they're communicating, there's a lot of energy usage there, and oxygen is pretty much required. So the big question is, where did it come from? So it turns out the geologists told us when it appeared, and that was about 2.5 billion years ago. There was a big spike of oxygen on Earth, and the only organisms around that we know that would have produced that oxygen were the cyanobacteria,
right,
which are sometimes called blue-green algae, which is not a great name because they have nothing to do with algae. They're really bacteria, but that's okay. Some of them live in the ocean, and some of them live in deserts on land. A lot of people don't realize that almost half of the species live on land, which is relevant to one of the findings that my group made a few years ago with cyanobacteria, that they're part of a group of bacteria that invaded land, perhaps the first continents on Earth about 3 billion years ago, and probably evolved this ability to produce oxygen at that time. And why that would have occurred? Well, probably from intense solar radiation, as you would get out in the desert or on land when there's no ozone layer to protect us from the UV or protect the bacteria from the UV radiation. It's very intense, much more intense than in the ocean, like their relatives would have been exposed to. And the ability to produce oxygen, in fact, we know, came from evolutionary manipulations of these pigment systems that most organisms have. And those pigment systems are originally there to protect the organisms from the sun's radiation. So in a sense, it's all related, and it's related to the colonization of land, apparently, by these bacteria.
But certainly you're saying oxygen is a key ingredient and a catalyst.
That's true. It's a catalyst, no doubt. And the main thing, it just gives us a lot of energy to build complex life.
We're talking with Dr. Blair Hedges, who's evolutionary biologist in the Department of Biology at Penn State University. And his topic is hotspots in the coevolution of life and Earth. Talk a little bit about coevolution for a minute, if you would.
Yeah. So the word coevolution refers to reciprocal changes. In other words, when one species affects the change of another, and that other species in the reverse direction affects change of the first one. So it's a two-way evolutionary street, I guess. And when I use that term, or when it's used for life and Earth, something very different like that. And of course, Earth is not living. Now, some people would say it probably is, but physically, the rocks and the minerals and the chemicals, they're not really living.
But they're not stationary either, are they?
No, they're not. They're changing all the time. And so the word coevolution applied to that is applied a little loosely. We usually refer to two living forms, but in this case, it's a living and a non-living. One being life and the other being Earth. So the thought here is that most people can understand and see how the Earth would affect life. And you just look out in the desert, you see the plants that are real spiny, like cacti. They're very well adapted to life in a dry area. They don't have big leaves or else they would lose their water. It's a little bit harder to see how life, like a cactus, could affect the Earth. You know, it seems like it's just sitting there growing and eking out a living. But in fact, if you step back a little bit and look at the whole Earth, what this cactus is doing and what other plants are doing, they're producing oxygen and a lot of it. And that's helping to oxidize the Earth's surface and change the chemistry of the Earth and chemistry of the atmosphere. It gives the atmosphere ozone, which protects us from harmful radiation. So when this event happened 2.5 billion years ago that I was just mentioning, this rise in oxygen, it had a major effect on the Earth's surface, and it turned rocks red, for example, and it changed the ocean chemistry. And it can also change weathering patterns and on and on. So that's what I mean by the coevolution of life and Earth.
And really, I'll use a term from the communications industry, which is interdependence. In other words, we often like to describe things as separate, the microphone, the headphones, but everything interacts. Everything is interdependent on the Earth and in life. And so it seems quite logical that there would be this reflexive relationship where one impacts the other. And that's a little more complex and harder for a scientist to get all those independent variables for, isn't it?
That's true. It's and it requires, I guess you could say, multidisciplinary efforts,
yeah,
like we're doing within this NASA Astrobiology
Explain
Institute.
More.
Yeah, so this was set up in 1998 to kind of be a front end for NASA's research and stimulate discoveries within NASA. It doesn't cost NASA a whole lot compared to their overall missions, which are very, very costly to send anything up in space. but there are a lot of benefits that they're getting from it. And so they have, I don't know the total number, but it would be hundreds of scientists across the U.S. and also in other countries that are working in teams to address astrobiological questions, which would be to search for life in the universe and all the different aspects of that statement. And that includes past life and also life on other planets, extrasolar planets. Because it was only a few weeks ago I saw in a journal in Nature, they've discovered, NASA scientists, extrasolar planets around the nearest star, mm-hmm. Alpha Centauri. Mm-hmm. It's a name of a star that most people know because it's our closest star.
And they always refer to it when they start to talk about stars as the closest star.
Yeah, and it's so neat to see that, you know, there are planets around that the nearest star. That means there are probably planets everywhere.
Well, I think what you point out is that, and I think all the scientists who've come before these microphones have pointed this out, the more we know, almost the less we know.
Yeah, life is resilient. And that's the one characteristic that is somewhat surprising because you see a lot of life around you seems very fragile. But overall, in terms of the whole Earth, when we mess up our environment to the point where almost everything disappears, there will be species that will survive. I'm not sure we're going to be that species, maybe, hopefully.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Blair Hedges continues with a look at places on Earth where we've only just begun to discover the variety of life. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1177. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Blair Hedges, an evolutionary biologist at Penn State University. He's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina, as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. The conversation continues with a look at places on Earth where scientists are only just exploring and discovering new forms of life.
One of the things I think that might astound many people is that there are still these pristine areas in the world where we haven't actually explored. Some forests, for example, and some places we haven't been able to get to that we've even found species we thought were extinct or even new species. I think in one video I saw, you found a new species of frog.
Yeah, and that's what really attracts me to this field in general of evolutionary biology is that you can make all kinds of discoveries like that. And so one thing I do in my other research is I go to the Caribbean islands and look for new species of vertebrates that would be frogs and lizards and snakes. And sometimes I run across very small ones.
Oh, sure.
Very small snakes.
Because a fingernail, I've seen at least one of the frogs that you were looking at.
That's true. And I've been doing work in Haiti for the last, 3 years intensely using helicopters to go up to this last remaining forest on these mountains. And, we usually spend one night. The helicopter drops us off, and we set up camp and walk around and collect, and then they hopefully pick us up the next day.
You might not even be able to see them right away. I saw in this one video they had to come through some mist before they appeared above you and landed on the side of the hill.
That's true, and that actually happened again in June. We were stuck on this mountain, and this little mini hurricane came through.
Whoa.
And I had a satellite phone, and I said, it looks like an opening in the clouds. Come and get us right now. And they came and grabbed us. But on that mountain, we found another one of these new frogs the size of your fingernail on your small finger, which is almost the smallest species of frog in the world. It's in the top 10, or I guess you could say the bottom 10. And it lays green eggs like Dr. Seuss's green eggs and ham.
That's right. There you go.
All kinds of weird things are showing up.
Is it the Hedges frog? Is that what we're going to call it or what?
No, you never name things after yourself.
I see. Well, yeah. Maybe that comes later, right?
Maybe Zeus-eye.
Nice. Well, certainly, as we talk about evolution, I can't avoid this subject, and it's one that has been fraught with the political end of it. But scientists out of Cornell recently we spoke to, and some of their climate analysis, definitely showing that the climate is changing and that species are adapting. So from your perspective, you don't have to make it a political discussion, but are we really seeing this exponential warming? And are you witnessing this climatic change affecting life on Earth?
You know, I am seeing, obviously seeing a lot of environmental change where I do my field work in the Caribbean. Now, most of that is destruction of the habitat, the trees. So I can't say that I'm actually observing climate change in action. And I'm not sure anybody can say that on any given day. It's something that you really have to step back and look at the patterns over multiple years, like many scientists have done. And they pretty much confirmed with those data that it's happening. So any individual scientist like myself in the field, you know, I'm not going to be seeing that on a day-to-day basis. But what I am seeing is destruction of the environment. And the reason I'm working in Haiti is because it's probably one of the world's first mass extinctions of a biodiversity of a major country. And that is because the forest is almost gone. It's down to 1% forest.
We're talking about all forms of life on Haiti in the forests.
Well, yeah. Because when you think about it, on land in the tropics, most of the land surface is covered with forest, some type of forest. Sure. Usually rainforest, sometimes dry forest. And the people who live in these areas, they need the wood for energy, basically to cook. And so even when they're given food by international food organizations, they still have to cook it like rice. And to cook it, they need energy. They don't have electricity, so they're making charcoal, and that's where the trees are going.
Huh.
So what I'm seeing is mountaintops. The reason I'm using a helicopter is the only places left where I'm finding anything.
The tops of these mountains.
Up on the very remote areas on the tops of mountains. And last year I visited a couple of major ones in northern Haiti that were completely destroyed. The forest had been cut about 5 or 10 years ago, so I was about 5 or 10 years too late. But the other ones, I usually get there just before that happens, and the only place that's left is a very small area. You can pretty much sometimes throw a rock from one side to the other where the forest is left. And once you find that forest, you know, all the orchids and the birds and the insects and the frogs are happily living and interacting, not realizing that
their time is numbered in that spot.
Time is numbered. Yeah. And so I'm documenting what I can, and I'm bringing out species, for example, frogs. I'm bringing to the Philadelphia Zoo to be captive bred to maintain the species. And I'm freezing some in liquid nitrogen for possible cloning in the future.
Wow.
100 years in the future, we can bring them back to life. So, I mean, it's sad to think.
A sort of repopulation scenario?
That's true, yeah. If people come to their senses and these problems, these major problems are worked out and the forests come back somehow, then by doing this, we could possibly clone these species back, not all of them, but some of them, and repopulate the forest. So those are a couple of different mechanisms to save some of the species, but we don't want to resort to that. These are last-ditch efforts.
You know, one of the things you made mention of was adaptation, that all these species have to adapt when things begin to change, and life seems to be able to adapt no matter what. Well, if we look at human life and the climate, we're going to have to do the same thing, aren't we? They've already started talking about how we're going to retrofit cities and plan for inundation of seawater and, you know, more rain in the Northeast, according to the climate scientists at Cornell. And what does that mean for dams? So there's what we think of as animal life, let's say, that adapts. But humans aren't free and separate from the Earth, and therefore we need to adapt as well.
That's true. And I consider the last and final hotspot that I'm talking about to be the one that's going on right now, and that is the one where humans, our one species, is so greatly affecting the Earth, the surface of the Earth, the existing life, like I'm seeing in Haiti, and the climate, the atmosphere, that we're definitely going to have to adapt to this new environment that we're creating ourselves, or we're going to disappear just like the other species that are disappearing on Earth.
Here's an existential question for you. Ready?
Okay.
Is it possible we're bacteria?
Well, yeah, I mean, in a sense, we are. We're not bacteria. We're complex life. But in the sense of...
We act a little bit like bacteria, though, don't we, Dr. Hedges?
Yeah, in I think in the sense of sometimes not having a lot of intelligence, I guess, if that's what you're getting at.
But we may attach ourselves onto our environment. We maybe cause problems for that environment. Uh-huh. We are not helping the Earth, according to some, by some of the methodology that we practice. So we cause damage. Not all bacteria is bad, though. I understand that. But you follow my logic there, right?
Yeah, that's true. I think we're worse than most bacteria, though, honestly.
My point. Yes. So in other words, each and every one of us, even as a single organism, life is change, and that's essentially what you're helping us understand.
That's true. It is. And I think the moral, if there is one here, is that even though in the real world organisms often behave selfishly, I think humans have to stop behaving selfishly and think in the long term, you know, for the good of Earth, for the good of humanity, and for the good of society. And I think once we do that, it'll be a first step in solving some of these problems.
Dr. Blair Hedges is an evolutionary biologist at Penn State University. He spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina, as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. You can learn more about his work at hedgeslab.org. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in partnership with the University of Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. You can learn more about all of the topics in our astrobiology series at origins.rpi.edu. I think we've discovered today that living conditions can affect life's normal everyday functions. And look, that's also the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. The process by which living plants and animals capture and release carbon is one of the fundamental forces of nature. But as Jason Keller, assistant professor of ecology at Chapman University, reveals, there is one unique environment where living organisms break the rules of the carbon cycle.
When you flip on a switch, the resulting flow of electrons provides the energy necessary to turn on a light. In much the same way, the flow of electrons through cells provides the energy necessary for life. In human cells, electrons generally flow from organic matter, the food we eat, to oxygen, the air we breathe. The same flow of electrons is also important in the process of microbial decomposition. When a leaf falls to the forest floor, microbes use this organic matter as a source of electrons. The electrons eventually find their way to oxygen, thus generating the energy the microbes need to survive. Things become even more interesting when you add water. In flooded environments, like wetlands, oxygen is not readily available to accept the electrons flowing from organic matter. Under these anaerobic conditions, microbes breathe a variety of other substances in place of oxygen. For example, there are microbes that can breathe the compound sulfate. To see, or rather smell, this microbial process, take an egg out of your refrigerator and place it in the sun for a few days. The characteristic rotten egg smell is hydrogen sulfide, the end product of microbes moving electrons from organic matter to sulfate. Other microbes can breathe forms of nitrogen, carbon dioxide, and even solid metals, including iron and manganese. Recently, we've discovered that some microbes can actually breathe organic matter in place of oxygen. Students in my laboratory have demonstrated that microbes moving electrons from one form of organic matter to another dominate decomposition in some wetland soils. The decomposition of organic matter using these alternative electron acceptors is generally slower than it would be if oxygen were available. At the global scale, this inefficiency has resulted in wetlands storing roughly 75 times the amount of carbon released annually from fossil fuel burning in their soils. Understanding the fate of this carbon in the face of global change depends on tracking the flow of electrons through the breathing of tiny microbes.
That was Jason Keller of Chapman University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.